Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to Regulating AI, a podcast that brings many diverse global voices to the discussion of creating democratic, fair, and equitable AI regulation around the world. Today, we have the privilege of interviewing Professor Brian P. Schmidt, the winner of the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics and a renowned astrophysicist from the Australian National University. Professor Schmidt is most widely known for his groundbreaking work on supernova, gamma ray bursts, cosmology, and the discovery of cosmic acceleration. Professor Schmidt has served as the 12th Vice Chancellor and President of the Australian National University from 2016 to 2023. With his expertise and passion for evidence-informed policy, education, quality, and global sustainability, Professor Schmidt is an invaluable voice in the discussion of regulating AI. Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast, Brian.
G'day. Nice to see you.
Wonderful. Brian, how do you see the current state of AI regulation globally, and what are the key challenges we face in this area?
Well, I think right now it's the Wild West. We have a rapidly changing technology that we can see doing more and more things. We don't have a regulatory environment tuned for it at all. Indeed, people are sitting sort of watching what happens. And I think that the way it's being regulated is essentially how you regulate any company or person. There's a certain level of responsibility, but I think it's fair enough to say it's out in front of any regulation at this point. And so, yeah, I think that right now we're in the infancy, but we're going to see this beginning to cause lots of problems. It's going to ultimately, I think it'll slow down AI development, but potentially a huge amount of harm could be done between now and when, you know, the legal ramifications of what's going on right now actually make it way through courts and becomes very expensive for, I think, a lot of companies and individuals would be my guess.
So what you're saying is right now it's basically self-regulation and it could all come to a head. Switching to where you are based, what is Australia's approach to AI regulation? Brian, can you, for our listeners, and just so that to set the perspective, we have a global base of listeners. We have policymakers, congressmen, senators, their staff, policy hawks. We have think tanks, industry leaders as our audience. So tell them, where does Australia stand in terms of AI regulation?
So I think we'd be pretty similar to most of the Anglo world. We do have, as a society, Australia is prepared to be a bit more interventionist than, for example, the United States. So we have a position that was created 4 or 5 years ago called the E-Safety Commissioner. Hmm. And this is a position that is a government position, but it has a lot of independence from the government of the day. And E-Safety Commissioner is able to go in and essentially put in injunctions, go in and call things out very publicly. So that at some level is the most sophisticated tool we have. It is a sophisticated office and they try to make pretty reasonable calls, but they're a very reactive group, right? They're out there if they see, you know, behavior on Facebook, which they think violates various parts of the Australian rule book, they can intervene. We have had, you know, in a few places over the last 5 or 7 years, our legislature through a parliament try to regulate, but it's you know, I would describe it as grossly misaligned with what's going on, sort of a box-checking exercise that was out of date the moment it was created. So those have sort of fallen by the wayside. At present, I would say there is the regulation is done through self-regulation and the threat of legal sanctions, where corporations, individuals are essentially, forget that it's AI, it's just that they're a human or a corporation and they have responsibility on those bases. And I think it's probably not a stupid way of doing it if we get more sophisticated to understand what the rules really are. But that e-safety commissioner, I think, is something that's fairly novel here. And it's Julia McGrath's the person who's in that position, and she's very effective in the areas that she is able to work. But it's a small group, so it's, big problem, small group.
So just to follow up on that, Brian, the e-safety commissioner is going to do something like this. So two questions. One, does that group have AI level expertise? And I'm not talking just technical machine learning, but you know what I'm talking about. That would be question one.
So it's a pretty sophisticated group. So I think they're not going to go out and do their own large language model, but
Of course.
they understand and have the ability to talk, for example, to my experts
Okay.
at the university, and they come in and they will grab our experts, do work. So they will get the technical expertise that they want, and they're prepared to go and get whatever they need or want. So it's very sophisticated that way.
Okay, that's wonderful. The other thing I wanted to ask you is like the EU has recently passed the EU AI Act. In the US, we've got over 100 bills that have worked their way through Congress. So obviously, we have elections happening here, so there's not much going to happen, but we have a executive order from the White House. Is there anything, this is for our audience to know, anything similar through the Australian Parliament or anything that has kind of come out or any possibility of that, or is it just self-regulation basically?
So at this point, there's nothing as extensive as that.
Okay.
We've had interventions in media. So there's places where you see it where it's obliquely. So Australia had a big intervention in how Google, Facebook, et cetera, deal with media. And there are aspects of AI in that. And so that was a very, well, it's a set of regulations I'm not very keen on. Very interventionist. But at this point, I think we're, as a small jurisdiction, waiting and seeing what's going on the very big things like the EU and the United States. I would not be surprised that we wouldn't follow some hybrid of the European and American approach. That would be in line with what Australia does, but at this point, I do not know of any activity to do that here.
One final point, and then we'll switch, is in the US, especially given that we have elections coming up and there are 60 countries with elections, there is a big concern about deep fakes and those kinds of things intervening in elections. Has anything like that happened or any of that kind of concern in Australia at all?
There's certainly concerns, and indeed, I talked a lot about this at a national
Yes.
press club at the
Yes.
end of last year. And there are concerns. It's talked about, but then the question I would ask is, well, and what are we doing about it? And the answer is, I don't see any activity being actually done to contemplate a very large amount of new material coming, digitally over the next 12, 18 months. And so, with respect to our own elections, the security agencies are looking and monitoring. And so I think it is being looked at and monitored. We haven't been the campaign of a international, activities as near as I can tell. And so right now it's kind of individuals misbehaving rather than any mass thing. But would we be ready for a mass onslaught? I don't think so. I don't see the preparation put in place here.
Okay. Brian, given your background in astrophysics, how do you think AI technologies could revolutionize scientific discovery in your field?
Well, so my Nobel Prize, which goes back into the 90s, I used a two-layer neural network even back in like 1995, 1996 to do defect detection in my pipeline because I had millions of things to detect and, doing it by hand was hard. So that's a good insight into where it's just a no-brainer. It can go through and lots of things that we do right now as scientists, where we're just sort of turning a crank, trying to, be filters rather than actually thinkers. Any place that, then I think AI is already being used a lot and will be used more and more and more and more. I think as it gets more sophisticated, and we can see that, it'll be interesting. Science is very creative. And so the question is, how are we going to use it? So for me, we're using AI to do interpolation. So imagine I have a very computationally expensive model I want to run, but I need to run that model a lot of times. So I have enough supercomputer power to run, let's say, 10,000 of those models. But when I'm trying to fit a model to data, those 10,000 are not nearly enough. I need to be able to kind of fit where the algorithm takes me. Turns out AI can interpolate amongst those models extraordinarily well, kind of frighteningly well. And so that's a little place where we're using it, and it speeds computation up by, 10 to the six. And you can see it, that it's the moral equivalent if you look at in games where they do the ray tracing of reflections and stuff. You calculate it, and then you can interpolate with AI, and it essentially gets the answer right, good enough all the time. So there's things like that where it's very, very important. Where I don't think it's going to be used is to, come up with new solutions. It will be very good at taking lots of information and essentially applying the principles that we already know. So I think the best case in science, the most radical piece of new knowledge was AlphaFold doing protein folding. Now, AlphaFold didn't, in my opinion, invent anything new there, but it took all the information we had and was able, through AI, to come up with solutions we had never seen before. So it's not particularly creative, but it's a brute force way of solving things that are really hard. So those are, I think, the most exciting things right now, but people will use it in ways I haven't even thought about. And that's the creativity of science.
Just for our audience, folks who are not astrophysicists, would it imply more discoveries? Would it mean that, let's say it took you a certain amount of time for your discovery to win Nobel Prize, would it compress time? I'm trying to put it for layman like me. What does that mean, Brian?
So it will, I think, allow scientists to make their discoveries quicker because it just speeds everything up. So I'm going to write code. I mean, I wrote 150, 200,000 lines of code for my Nobel Prize. Well, now you're going to have Copilot or something helping you write that code, and it's going to be a lot faster. When I go through and I do all these things I had to do manually, it's going to speed that up. When I want to calculate, as I said, a set of models. When I went through and had to calculate, for example, is the universe accelerating or decelerating back in 1997 when we were doing the calculations? That took days, right? And these new techniques could make it into seconds. And so it just speeds up every little bit and a piece. So that's the obvious bit. The unobvious bit is then it allows you to do something you just simply cannot do, a breakthrough like AlphaFold doing protein folding. Those are the creative ones that I don't know what it's going to do in advance. I think it's very hard to do those, but it clearly can do it. And that's the place where you might just simply be able to do new things, make new discoveries that are beyond humans on their own. And that's, I guess, the exciting part, but also a little bit of the scary part where, that's the future. It's hard to predict.
Yeah, so speeding things up, but there are obviously challenges to that. Brian, are there any lessons from past regulatory frameworks in other scientific domains that you worked on that we could learn when it comes to shaping AI policy?
Well, probably the closest thing that we have is ethics within. We have ethics committees mainly to deal with human-based research. So I'm an astronomer, but I ran a university, so I know about that. And it's quite interesting to see what's on an ethics committee. You have ours is led by a philosopher, and then you have biologists, you have psychologists, you have a range of very diverse community. Looking and understanding the human effects of things we do, including AI, it would turn out. So we're already self-regulating AI through an ethical framework. Now, before ethics committees were big, people went out and did experiments that we consider now to be amoral, immoral, having sometimes terrible consequences because it was unregulated. And now there was self-regulation, the individual human had to make decisions. Is this okay? Or can I bring 40 undergraduates and, do shock tests on them depending on what they're doing, which we now know is probably not okay, without a lot of bit around it. So I actually think the notion of an ethics, a really sophisticated ethics committee, and may I say, an ethics committee has absolute authority within the university. That is, I, as the president of the university, cannot overrule it. It's a diverse committee that do not have conflicts of interest on the ideas, and it's a sophisticated way of taking a set of higher principles, which is not doing harm. And so I think those will be very useful for companies, universities, corporations. How does it then work within government? Well, the government for universities says you're self-regulating well enough through these committees that we're prepared for you to do it this way. Now, if that committee gets something wrong, the government will come after the United States, after the university. So I have every reason to make sure that that ethics committee will support the university if we were to be legally taken on by the government. And thus far, for us at least, no issues. It's very sophisticated, and I don't feel any threat about it not being able to satisfy a government, a court, whatever. So that's one insight. But I think that works to a point, but it's not going to work for bad actors. It's not going to work for individuals. So, there's going to have to be a set of norms, I think, about what's okay and what's not. But it is, I think, quite effective on corporations and big organizations.
So, Brian, incidentally, right now, there is a big conversation and a movement happening in large corporation, let's say large Fortune 500, to set up ethics committees and ethics boards. In your case, again, for our listeners, is your ethics committee made up of university employees or are these independent people from outside?
In our case, it's largely people within the university, but it can bring people from outside if it wants to, other universities. And I think one of the things that's different about a whole culture of a university is a university, you have academic freedom. I cannot fire you. Right? No matter what you do. That's not true in a Fortune 500. So the setup we have is a little different. So if I were a Fortune 500 company, I might have some internal people who are on that, but I would definitely have it loaded with externals just based on the challenges of a true conflict of interest. Because for a corporation, this could be existential, making a decision to do something or not do something, where we know within a university it almost never is existential. So it's a little bit
right.
different.
So they could have, like, they have these boards, just a regular board of directors. They could have people, eminent people coming in, as you said, philosophers, etc., in their organizations, and they would have the independence. Because generally, as you know, in corporations, if you have internal staff, there is a dotted line somewhere, and there are some pressure points that could happen. So that's a good perspective, as we've had a lot of our guests come in and they talk about these ethics boards. So that's a very, there's a topic du jour going on right now in corporations in the U.S. So that insight is very helpful. Brian, in the speech you mentioned earlier, you also talked about the potential danger of learned helplessness and humanity becoming over-reliant on AI for thinking. How can we, firstly, could you explain to our listeners what do you mean by that? And then how do we strike a balance between leveraging AI's capabilities, you know, the things that you said can speed things up, and then preserving human agency and critical thinking skills?
Yeah, well, this is, it's easy to talk about the problem, hard to actually figure out a solution. The problem is the following. If I look at how I learn, how students learn, and, right up from kindergarten on, you learn by doing, right? And mm-hmm. learning to think, make mistakes. So let's talk about physics. Well, I start doing physics problems and I make mistakes and I learn from my mistakes and I redo it and I redo it and I try new things I've never seen before and I break again and I learn by essentially continually making mistakes. And then after 15 years of this, I have made huge numbers of mistakes. I'm beginning to see how all these patterns fit, and I can start potentially going through and then being creative and saying, well, what I've learned here in condensed matter physics might well work in gravitation. Mm-hmm. Now, the idea, thus far, I've seen no evidence that the creative aspect that AI can do at all right now. Okay, some people may disagree with me, but at this point, I have seen no evidence that AI can kind of have a leap of thought like Einstein did when he thought of general relativity. That's probably an extreme example. So imagine you start using ChatGPT, as many, many students do, and instead of, so you have it just kind of help you all the time. So that instead of making mistake after mistake after mistake, it helps you get the right answer much, much faster. Right. Mm-hmm. So the problem I see is that you get the answer faster, but you're going to have a much less, as a human, developed understanding of physics. And as after 15 years of this, you're going to be much less capable than of breaking new ground when you get to the things that AI cannot do. So the AI can get you all the way up. Literally, we'll probably be able to do to the cutting edge of physics that we teach right now. But by its current design, it's not going to do the new physics. And humans are not going to be trained to do the new physics either. And so we end up in a place where our knowledge kind of just kind of asymptotes to where it is right now. Because AI will do everything we know incredibly well, but it's not going to push the boundaries in the same way that humans do. And so that's that learned helplessness, where we become helpless in the future to do anything new because we're so good at doing what we already know now with AI. And that is a real risk. How am I thinking about, I'm teaching next year and trying to think about how to get students to use things. And what I'm trying to do is to put people on the frontier of thinking with AI much earlier, but then forcing them to make mistakes with AI and make that cycle of mistakes. But you have to then put people to the frontier much faster, where AI isn't going to help them or get them to do problems that AI has not yet figured out how to do. And so that frontier, I'm learning exactly how I can do reasonable problems that put people in that cycle of learning by doing rather than learning by regurgitating, which is what I think the danger is.
So learning by doing, not regurgitate. Just two quick questions on this point. We've had a lot of guests that come in and we've raised this issue with them, and they always give us the example of the calculator, that, hey, we used to count and, you know, figure out how to do it, and the calculator came in and, you know, we didn't need to do all these things. Whatever critical thinking was involved in 2 plus 2 or 8 times 9 or whatever the division, the pi, etc., we are applying that thing to better things. I don't know your reaction to that point.
Yeah, and so learning math, so let's just take times tables. Mm-hmm. So do I do everything by a calculator? The answer is I still know my times tables really, really well. And I still do mental arithmetic all the time. And the reason is because I can do things right now, at least, I'm much faster in my head as orders of magnitude in trying to think through a problem. So do I think kids don't know need to know how to do these things? So the answer is no, I actually think you still need to know your times table, even though I have a calculator. Now, I use my calculator to do almost all my multiplication, but, you know, sometimes I still do it just to make sure I know it. But it's also thinking through, like, how do you calculate pi? You know, well, do we? So kids need to know that too. How do you actually calculate a square root? I know how to calculate a square root. Mm-hmm. I use called Newton's method. You iterate through. That's how my calculator does it. I can go down and I can write that on a board right now. I learned that in high school. Okay, so those things are still useful because they help me, and I use those techniques to solve other problems at the edge of astrophysics. So you still need to know them. You can't. Right. You can't just say, I'm going to go through and use my calculator to do every order of magnitude thing because it's slow. Right? And maybe some sort of implant that Elon Musk puts into your brain and can speed the bit up. But I still think those things are part of the wiring we need to creatively solve new problems. That's why I think I'm worried about it. And yeah, we're going to use it all the time, like a calculator. But it doesn't mean you don't actually have to slog through and learn it still.
So we need to slog through and learn it still. Final point, you made a very important thing. I talked about the peak, reaching the peak for AI if we lose our creative thinking. That's a very important point. Do you have a, let's just say if we stopped our critical thinking, when do you think the peak would happen? Is there some kind of a timeline or something in your mind?
Well, it's long, so it's uncomfortably, it would take, people like me exist. I'm 57. Mm-hmm. Actually, I have people who are 20 years younger than me that exist who are 37. So it would take 40, 50, 60 years probably to come crashing, but it's going to slow down. So you would see slowdown very quickly because the 18, 20-year-olds are very creative normally.
Yeah.
Most people do a lot of their best work, like it or not, before they're 30 because they're, they don't know what they don't know. They're very creative and risky.
Right.
And you would really kill, I think, their creativity because they won't have the tools to do it. So you'd see a slowdown, I think, within a decade. But the machine wouldn't come grinding to a halt, I think, or wouldn't, I'd say an asymptote. I think you'd see that in 50 years. I don't know. It kind of feels like a dystopia of some future sci-fi movie where,
Boy.
you know, well, I think it's already been written, right? It's just something where Brave New World or whatever, where everything is sort of in a status quo, run by a machine, and that's kind of what it's going to feel like. Is it'll, it might be fine. Maybe it's, maybe we would be better being some sort of sustainable equilibrium. But yeah, it would certainly be different than the rest of humanity's history.
Wow. 40, 50 years, as you said, maybe it's like a sci-fi movie, the reverse of Minority Report or something like that. Who knows?
Yeah.
That's
It's like a Brave New World or 1984 is what it, because
right.
you're going to have, you know, in the end, the machines will be doing everything, because we will become more and more helpless over time. That's the challenge.
Wow. Yeah. Brian, switching, just getting your thoughts, how can we make sure that the AI systems are developed and deployed where we uphold ethical principles and protect fundamental human rights by, you know, in the development of these systems?
So again, I think we need to, if I were going to have an AI regulation, I would have a series of principles that are very high level, that look like a human rights charter or whatever. So it's a set of principles, and we tell companies, these are the principles we expect you, anything you do, tech, AI, whatever, you have to abide by that. And if you don't, you are breaking the law, and we're going to come after you. And I would just make it a high level set of principles. So if you deploy things that have, you know, massive racial biases in them, that's just like being a racist. You're held up. That is against a principle, and you are responsible for the tech you deploy not doing that. And again, you're going to have ethics committees, and you're going to have to put in some stuff that we're not used to right now to have confidence that you're doing that. But, you know, we don't allow people to go out and kill people on the street with, you know, without consequence right now. And just because you have an AI driving vehicle, you know, I think everyone understands that if someone's responsible, someone has responsibility for that car if it runs a pedestrian over. And what's interesting is I think it's going to be a dilemma is, let's take the AI driving car. Right now, if you can demonstrate, if you're, let's say, Tesla, that we are 10 times safer than a human driver, well, like it or not, I, as a human driver, when I hit someone, I have responsibility. Tesla is not going to get a free pass. Even if they're 10 times better than me, they're going to be responsible for every single person they hit and hurt or kill. And there's no going around that. You don't get through it just because you're 10 times better. And I don't see... I think people get themselves into a quandary. So, well, because they're 10 times better, no responsibility is had. Well, that's not true right now. If it's a genuine accident that's shown to be beyond their control, fine. But I think this is going to start rearing its ugly head and slow down AI, because it turns out that if you're going to do things safely, against these principles, you just can't go as fast as we're going right now. And you know what? That doesn't bother me. I think going a little slower and getting it right is fine. I actually think that's good. I don't think the future of the world depends on how fast billion-dollar corporations roll out their AI when it's deeply flawed. I think the upside, the downside are there's a fair bit of symmetry in both directions. So I think that responsibility is going to have to be there, but it cannot be a, you know, 400-page document with specifics. It's going to have to be principles aligned, just like we deal with humans.
So you raise a couple of interesting questions, if I may follow up. You said if, you know, Tesla cannot get away if the car kills someone. So there's a big question, and things are now bubbling up. As you know, in the United States, we are a litigious society, and lawyers, are going to look at some of these things. So if AI does harm, who is going to be responsible? The builder of the systems, the implementer of the systems, the user of the systems, all of the above? Or it depends?
So I think, I mean, what's going to happen in the United States, whoever has the money will be blamed. And that's why we need some regulation that comes in.
Right.
So I think that, like a handgun,
mm-hmm.
So is Colt 45, you know, or whatever, is the firearm manufacturer responsible for every death that occurs with a firearm? No, it's the person who has agency to fire mm-hmm. the gun. That's where the responsibility lies. But a class action could be made against the firearm manufacturer if it's seen that through recklessness of design, it's kind of built in the ease of creating harms, right? So I think it's going to be a very similar situation on AI. Is the companies that create AI, so let's say a fake video generator that does deep fakes of anyone, okay? So if I use that and I do illegal activity, clearly I'm responsible. But if Google has built that and enabled lots of people to do illegal things, clearly they have a level of responsibility as well. So I think it's going to look very, very similar to what we do with other bits of technology. And I do think overthinking about it isn't right. Ultimately, humans are going to be responsible, not the AI. And if we start getting to the point where the AI is responsible, then it probably has replaced us. And at that point, I'm pulling the electric cords out of the wall because I figure it's over. So humans have responsibility. And I would, as I said, I've given the firearm. I think it's going to be a very, very similar type of thing to that.
So humans are responsible. I'm just going to very briefly mention a situation to you that happened. We had in the US, we have presidential elections. There were primaries in New Hampshire, and somebody did robocalls with the voice of President Biden saying you don't need to vote for the primary, the general election is what it counts. The technology used was by a company called 11 Labs, which does voice modulation, etc. And there was a company in Texas, etc. So now the challenge becomes is, and obviously the Federal Trade Commission and the FCC are coming down on it. So it's going to be interesting to see whether it's going to be 11 Labs, the company that did it, the person that did that. I think we are going to start seeing, as you said, some of these things that start coming in, Brian.
Yeah, and well, clearly the persons who did the fake calling, they clearly mm-hmm. have responsibility. That is criminal, and to my mind, no doubt about it. The question then is, did the company in Texas, did they create a piece of software where it was very clear that it was trivially easy for large amounts of people to do criminal activity with it? Then mm-hmm. I think they are culpable. If someone was really clever and took a piece of software and modified it, or went, showed real initiative and cleverness, then, at some point, I don't think they are responsible. But it comes down to, when is a gun manufacturer responsible for something versus the AI manufacturer? And, when things are new, companies tend to have more responsibility because there's no societal norm of what you can do with a gun. And then As I said, I think as we know, we have a voice modulator. Well, again, what's the purpose of that? What is the use case for that? That's not illegal. Is it a small bit of it? Is it a large bit of it? You know. So I you're right. I think it's going to be a very complicated next couple of years. But I would expect that a lot of companies like that are going to find themselves in deep trouble because they're going to be seen relative to a sensible set of principles. They have not actually acted as society would expect.
You also very briefly touched on a point that's of deep concern globally, that like social media, it seems like a few technology companies, primarily Silicon Valley or others, are going to dominate the world of AI because it is almost impossible for smaller companies to create these large language models. It costs about $1 billion or at least hundreds of millions of dollars to create that. Is that a concern to you in terms of either monopoly? Like right now, our global town square is controlled by five or six companies in terms of speech, whether it's the Googles or Facebook or Meta or X or Twitter, etc. Does that concern you?
Well, it absolutely does, but I don't have an easy way to fix it. So these are, you know, let's take large language models, which are interesting because, of course, they're so fluent. You know, they're the fluency of a large language model is, you know, we've gone from what I saw computers being hopeless at this stuff, but suddenly it's like, wow, this really can write stuff. Not always factually correct, but the grammar and that is wonderful. So having a high concentration, and the reasons you need a high concentration, as you say, is you need data on scale, you need computation at scale, and then you need to have those overheads of ethics and all these other things that are hard. So it's a naturally highly concentrated thing, but it's going to actually start looking like a sovereign capability. So Singapore, which I know, has spent a whole bunch of money doing their own LLM training exercise. So it's not you know, ChatGPT-4 scale thing, but it was a big one where they limited the training after obviously a set of a basic training through the LLMs, and they concentrated on the Singaporean data, language, etc. So they had a sovereign capability here. And it's not that they're going to nail it the first go, but they are ensuring that they have a sovereign capability in LLMs so that if the big four or five or whatever we want to call it go some other way, they have some agency and autonomy about their future. So that tells me that there may need to be a public square where there is literally a open, and I would say would have to be open, government-sponsored resource that had computation and you'd bid on it. So you're going to treat it just like a telescope. I have to go and write a proposal. It's very competitive. And I think creating a capability that is in the public square is going to become of national importance. And it's not going to just be the US that does this. It's going to be Canada. It's going to be France. It's going to be Germany. It's going to be Australia because they're too important. And that's how I would deal with it. I think you need to create, you can't just let big tech do it. And you know what? It will also create creativity because right now big tech does things that make money, right? And you know, just learning how to sell people things has really, really created some interesting opportunity, but it's also really slowed things down, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's how I would do it. I would create a national, well, observatory, except we'll call it a national capability, where the public and researchers and highly skilled people could go out and use it, and including small companies, right? So small companies have the right to bid into this as well.
So you raised a couple of interesting points, if I may follow up. One is in the United States, for our listeners, there is a scientific research body called the National Science Foundation. We've had the director of the National Science Foundation that has come in, and they are creating this, what you just said, the global, I mean, the national research institutions where academics and others can come in providing compute power, etc. But the other point that you touched on, Brian, is the sovereignty, the national sovereignty, but it also has implications. We've talked to people from smaller countries who have history, who have culture, and they want to retain that. And they are saying that if these large LLMs who kind of, you know, work on data on the internet, English language, Western civilization, or American civilization, we are small countries, let's say in Europe, etc. Should every country have their own, as you talked about, you know, large language model in some shape or form? It doesn't have to be for ChatGPT 4, 4.5 or 5, but just to retain their culture, values, etc.
I think they're going to have to, and we're going to get very sophisticated about, you know, where there's commonality in these, you know, so when you, your listeners, a lot of them will know that when you start with an LLM, you don't just start with a blank piece of paper these days. You have one that's been trained on lots of data that kind of figures out the basic way that the large language model in it, and it turns out that is quite universal across languages, right? So you can use that on Aboriginal languages, which are 65,000 years here, but obviously there's more distance. So they don't work quite as well as they do between French and Italian, which of course are very similar. Mm-hmm. So I do think, like Singapore, we're going to have to, those countries are going to have to invest in a capability that retains their culture and history. Because if they don't, it will be lost. And I feel particularly bad for a country like Estonia that is tiny and has a language which is probably the oddest of a small, you know, country in the world. Sorry, Estonians, but Estonians have a very funny language that doesn't really connect into too much else. So, you know, that's going to be hard work for them to keep their language going because it just is quite different than other things. So, but you know what? Researchers will figure out how to do this because clearly humans can do it. And, you know, right now, you know, an LLM trains on a lot more data than you and I have ever ingested in our lives. And that's what they need to do to get as good as up. But people will figure out how to make that easier and better and learn contextually and stuff. So, but I think it will be important.
Brian, you obviously are teaching students at the university. There have been all kinds of reports, whether it's IMF, McKinsey, et cetera, in terms of massive job transformation disruptions that are going to come, 30%, 60%, et cetera. You are now teaching the students, and obviously one of the purposes is that they go out and find employment. What are your thoughts? Firstly, do you think this transformation is going to happen? And secondly, what are your solutions? Because as someone who's teaching these students, you have, I presume, some sense of responsibility to them.
Yeah, so I do think a big transformation is coming. And so what I always tell students, tell your listeners, is if you can always have the machine be subservient to you, then you become a superhuman. Soon as you are subservient to the machine and it takes your job, you're in trouble. So when I teach students, and our university teaches students, we are very much looking at giving them capability of technology, augmenting their capabilities, not being replaced. Now, you know, ANU is one of the top 50 universities in the world, however you want to look at it. The reality is, you know, and this worries me, is that the most academically gifted and privileged people come to my university. And I am training them to be superhumans who can do 10, you know, the jobs of 10 other people. So I'm not really worried about my students, because we are training them to use this technology. I am worried that not everyone gets to come to my university, and indeed 99% of people don't. And there will be mass job loss, and, you know, it will probably re-equilibrate over the fullness of time. But, you know, when we go through and we think of the Luddites, that was real. The Luddites, a generation, many generations of people were really, really knocked back by that. And they eventually got jobs. But, you know, that didn't mind, you know, if you were the person born in 1835, that didn't matter, because you didn't get to learn how to use the new types of machines. You just, you know, had a terrible, miserable life. So there's going to have to be some sort of societal intervention. What we do know economically is that if you look, the return on capital has just been going up and up and up. So the more capital you have, the more your returns were. The return on labor has been going down, down, down. So humans are becoming less and less valuable. And I think that's going to continue. And we will break, right? We will break, because too many people are going to feel disenfranchised. And there's going to have to be some sort of reallocation, social intervention. And, you know, that's something's going to have to happen. I don't know what it's going to be. And it's going to be very different between the United States, which is very much you're on your own. You know, if you haven't made it, it's your own damn fault, and good luck, you know, get on with it. And Australia and Europe, which are very much, we have a social safety net. Let's think about how we can get people on into a reasonable life. But both of us are going to have troubles in this space, and it's going to require mass societal intervention, probably akin to what happened in the 30s in the United States.
So transformation, listeners, according to Brian, transformation is coming, and some kind of societal intervention is going to be needed, maybe a hybrid between the U.S., be on your own, take care of yourself, versus Australia, Europe, that, you know, provides a societal safety net. Brian, I could go on and on. There are so many other questions I still have, but I also value your time. As a respected scientist and thought leader, what advice would you give to policymakers and regulators who are, you know, struggling to come up with, you know, framework for responsible governance of AI? Especially, Brian, this is a technology that is evolving so fast. I mean, you know, our lawmakers around the world are not AI scientists, but they have to deal with ChatGPT, then multimodal, then Sora, then agents, super agents. What advice, in conclusion, from someone so prestigious and esteemed, would give to them?
Well, I would put together a group, a board of experts from quite a broad ranging things, not dissimilar to an ethics committee, but you need to have industry players in there, you need to have philosophers, you need to have researchers, you need to have bureaucrats. And then, quite frankly, you need to be taking advice. Now, politicians don't always follow advice, but they at least need to have a core, really good set of advice. And then I think another way to look and do things, which is overlooked, are effectively the citizen jury way, where you can go through with this group, bring in members of the public, explain to them what they're doing, and listen to the average person on the street through these citizen juries about what works for them. So, you know, experts and people like me are great, but it's got to connect to the average person in the street. And so I think you need that expertise and then a citizen jury type thing. That's what I would do. And then there's some hard decisions. And as I said, I think you're going to end up going against a set of principles and then holding companies and individuals against those set of principles. And the faster we can get to a system like that, I think the better. And those principles are beyond the actual individual technologies. I think most technologies right now, you can work through that. But as you said, the details do matter.
So for our lawmakers who are listening, have a group of experts, have citizen juries, have a certain set of principles that you can operate on. That's wonderful advice, Brian. Really want to express our gratitude for, you know, sharing your invaluable insights and perspectives on this crucial issue of how to regulate AI. You know, as we deal with the challenges, your insights have really helped, you know, give us some food for thought. And as we continue to navigate the complex landscape of AI development and deployment, we want to have as many diverse voices and that can foster international cooperation and prioritize ethical principles. We encourage our listeners to continue exploring this crucial topic and to actively participate in shaping the future of AI regulation. So thank you for joining us on Regulating AI, and we look forward to continuing this important conversation. Thank you so much, Brian, for joining us from across the globe. It's really, really been a pleasure. And like I said, I have so many other questions I wanted to ask you from some of your comments, some of your papers, but we'll have to have you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate the initiative you're taking in this very, very important area.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.